This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 2014, tens of thousands of families fled from Central America to seek asylum in the U.S. They came here to escape gangs and criminal violence in their home country. But their path to refuge has been anything but easy. A new report from the Marshall Project looks at the challenges families face as asylum seekers in immigration court. The challenges are especially stark at an immigration court in Charlotte. It has earned a reputation as one of the toughest in the country. Joining me now is Julia Preston. She's a contributor for the Marshall Project and reported this story. Welcome, Julia.
Hello.
Also with me is Atenas Burola. She is director and managing attorney of the Charlotte-based Immigration Integration Center, part of the nonprofit Latin American Coalition. She also represents asylum seekers in Charlotte's immigration court. Atenas, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Julia, let me start with you and give me the scope of this problem. Many families seeking asylum now showing up for court hearings. Nationally, give us a sense of what's going on here.
Well, these are families that started coming across the southwest border in large numbers in 2014, and they were funneled by the Obama administration into the asylum system. In many cases, they did not run from the Border Patrol. They turned themselves into the Border Patrol at the border, and they requested protection in the United States. And because the immigration courts are so clogged and overburdened, a lot of these cases are only now coming up for adjudication and decision by immigration judges in the courts. And the alarming figure that has emerged is that almost 70% of these asylum claims are ending in deportation orders that are issued by immigration judges in absentia to empty courtrooms because the families have not turned up for their hearings.
And this is interesting because the rate of asylum requests has risen since 2014, but approvals have been declining. And as you say, now we're talking about a 70% rejection rate. Tell us about the trends that are playing out in these courts.
The particular case of the Central American families is that they have a hard time making their cases in with the statute, the asylum statute as it currently exists. The asylum laws are shaped to favor more traditional claims of people who are fleeing from religious persecution or political persecution. But there is a part of the asylum law that does allow artful lawyers to make these claims and win these claims, but you really do have to have a lawyer who can articulate the case. And particularly in Charlotte, you have a situation where you have two out of now four judges who are sitting in that court who are very skeptical of these claims, and they have quite a low rate of grant of asylum cases in general, but particularly with these Central American families, they have been quite reluctant to grant these cases.
Atenas, let's talk about the reasons. Julia talked about many of these decisions happening in absentia. In other words, the families aren't even showing up at court. Why? Why not?
No, I think there are a variety of reasons that families don't, but there are two main ones. One is fear, and the other is misinformation. So a lot of families are afraid that if they go to court, they will be deported immediately. And the misinformation feeds into that, right? If people say, no, don't go to court, why are you going to bother going to court? You're just going to get a deportation order anyway. But related to the fear is the fact that in order to really win an asylum case, you need an attorney. In Charlotte, which serves both North Carolina and South Carolina, so in our Charlotte court, you cannot win an asylum claim without an attorney. And then if these low-income families can't find an attorney, we go back to they're afraid they're going to be deported, so they don't show up to court.
And they're complicated cases, too, and I would think the burden of proof, I mean, the idea that you are going to have to demonstrate the need for asylum means a lot of documents, and of course, leaving home, especially when you're in fear, means you may not have a lot of documents with you. I don't even know how an attorney can even take a case like that.
That is correct. The good thing about asylum law is that one of the things that counts as proof is the person's testimony. So if the judge believes the person, just their testimony alone can be sufficient to win asylum. Of course, that is not ideal, and it is better to have a lot of these supporting documents. But as you said, these are people who are fleeing for their lives, so they take just what they have to carry for an arduous journey. They don't bring a lot of the proof that they might have. We as attorneys try to get what we can from their home countries, but in a lot of cases, it is people's testimony that really carries our cases.
Tell us more about what qualifies as for asylum in this country. What would you have to say? What would you have to prove?
So the interesting thing is that it's a very case-by-case basis. The way our asylum laws are written is they're taken from international refugee and asylum law, but essentially you have to prove that you were persecuted based on one of five reasons. As Julia said, those reasons are historically written a little differently than what our political reality is. So they are race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or this nebulous thing called a particular social group. What this means in practicality is that asylum is not for people who are fleeing just general violence or economic instability, things like that. Somebody really has to have been persecuted for one of these five reasons in order to qualify. And what we are seeing is that a large portion of the women and children and men, but mostly women and children who are fleeing Central America, qualify under some articulation of a particular social group. There is no legal definition of a particular social group. So that is where we as lawyers have to figure out if somebody might qualify under some type of particular social group that has either been accepted by the courts or that could be if we think that it is viable.
Julia Preston, let's take a step back and look at how we got here. Tell us more about what happened with the border surge in 2014 and how these families ended up asking for asylum in the first place.
Well, I think it's important to remember that the primary countries that these families are coming from, Honduras and El Salvador, and to a lesser extent Guatemala, and also Mexico, have been vying with each other for the title of the murder capital of the world, particularly Honduras and El Salvador. There is a situation in those countries where you have these criminal gangs, the international criminal gangs, all related to the Mara Salvatrucha and its various offshoots, that are actually contesting control of whole neighborhoods, whole cities in some cases, and whole areas of the country. They are becoming alternative governing bodies, but they really don't have any other purpose except for extortion and violence and turf war. And these families get caught in between these gang battles. Their young teenage sons are subject to recruitment. Their daughters are threatened with sexual violence. So there is a significant threat that these families have faced and that has caused them to come in large numbers to the southwest border and ask for asylum. And once they pass an initial phase of asylum assessment, which they do at the border, and 85% of these families have passed that initial test, then they fan out across the country. They're released by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and they go out across the country to pursue their cases. Particularly in the Charlotte court, there has been a critical dearth of pro bono representation. And, for example, when I was in the court doing my reporting, the judges were handing out a piece of paper to the people that were coming before them and very sternly telling these immigrants that they needed to contact the lawyers on that list because they were providing pro bono services. And I found that none of the lawyers who were on that list had been practicing in either North or South Carolina for 3 years. Mm. And so at the very least, this court needs to improve the services that it's offering to people who are coming before it, so that they can look for pro bono services. And in addition to that, I'm hoping that people in the Charlotte area, lawyers, will realize how critical the need is in this immigration court for pro bono services. It is very difficult for a lawyer, an immigration lawyer, who has to make money to make a living, to take one of these cases because it's a kind of a hard dilemma for a lawyer, I think. You have to advise your client at the beginning what the chances are that you will win. And in the Charlotte court, the chances have not been good. And so there's a crisis of representation in the Charlotte area that I also think needs to be addressed.
Tennis, tell us more about that situation in Charlotte, where you're based.
Yeah, I think what Julia said is very true. There are, unfortunately, no nonprofit organizations in the state of North Carolina that consistently take adult asylum cases. There are a couple that will take some adult asylum cases, but not consistently. And even if they did, definitely not on a basis that would be able to provide lo bono or pro bono representation for everyone. As Julia was saying, the private bar also, so private immigration attorneys, are limited in the amount of pro bono cases that they are able to take because they have to eat, right? They have to pay their bills. And one of the issues that we face as immigration attorneys is having this expectation that no matter how strong our case is, if it is a Central American asylum-based claim, there's a high probability that it's going to lose. And this is something that I actually tell my clients, as well as the pro bono attorneys that I manage through an asylum pro bono project that we have. I tell them, you know, however strong their claim is, I might say, you know, I think you have a very strong claim based on what you suffered in your country. However, you have to be prepared to lose at the immigration court level. We might win at the appeal, but we are probably going to lose going in, and both of us need to be prepared for
that. So that might also be have a chilling effect on attorneys who would take on this work. If they're in Charlotte saying, nobody wins down here, I can't take this on, and I really can't afford to take a free case into appeal.
Absolutely. You know, I think attorneys in Charlotte and in North Carolina as a whole know going in that this is going to be significantly more difficult than, say, if they were practicing in New York or in Chicago, because we are assuming that there's a high likelihood we're going to lose and therefore that we're going to have to appeal. And this means, of course, that the case is going to take more time, which means it's going to be more expensive, which makes it harder for people to be able to do.
Well, let's get a sense of who these folks are that you're representing at Tennis. I know you're representing one woman in particular who fled Honduras with her children, and you can't give me her particular details, but maybe you can give me the details of her story while she remains anonymous. Can you tell us more about her?
Absolutely. I think this is actually a typical case, so it might be any number of people, but this woman in particular, her husband, they're not actually married, but she calls him her husband. So a local gang began threatening him and began threatening his family. They're not exactly sure why they were being threatened, but they started being threatened such so that she had to flee the town that they lived in with him. They fled to another town. They kept being threatened, and eventually over the course of about 5 years, his father was killed, one of his brothers was killed, one of his brothers-in-law was killed, and one of his brothers, as well as himself and my client, were shot at. Somebody tried to kill them. So this happened over the course of several years. They moved to several different places within the country that they are from. And eventually, he fled first. He had to flee because he was afraid that he would be killed or the rest of his family would be killed. And after he fled, she continued getting threats towards herself and her small son, their son in common, so that eventually she had to flee as well as other members of his family. Unfortunately, this is something that is very, very common. I don't like calling them gangs because they are not gangs in what we think of here in the United States. They really are more of these international criminal organizations that are controlling large parts of these countries, but they essentially go after families. And for a lot of people, the choice is either work with them, succumb to them, or flee or die, right? The choice they are given is actually a lot of times, you know, work with us or die. And people take a third choice, which is to flee.
Well, let me ask you about this. The complicating factor, it seems to me, from listening to you, is that the asylum law recognizes bona fide governments, however reprehensible, but if they're bona fide governments, but then these ex officio governments that are taking control of a region but aren't there by any constitutional authority. Is that harder to recognize as the dangerous factor in that country?
So what the statute actually says is that someone may qualify for asylum if they're being persecuted either by the government or by an agent that the government is unwilling or unable to control. Right. So in these countries, there's huge amounts of police corruption, of police impunity, of the police working with criminal elements. So what we have been arguing pretty successfully is that the government is unable to control these criminal elements in this country. And thus, that is why they qualify for asylum, even if it is not the government undertaking the persecution themselves.
And still we're seeing these high rejection rates, particularly in Charlotte. Julia, there used to be exceptions. ICE would make exceptions for families if they found their families had committed or the individuals had committed no crimes. Donald Trump has cracked down on immigration, says he's not going to take that into account. How is that affecting the situation in these courts?
Well, now you have the outcome of these cases. A very large proportion of these cases are ending with judges issuing deportation orders in absentia. So the families are not in court. They may not even know that the order was issued. And in the past, a deportation order like that might not have been an immediate risk of deportation. This deportation order is kind of the immigration equivalent of an arrest warrant. But under the Trump administration, President Trump has eliminated the discretion and the priorities that President Obama had established that encouraged immigration agents to really focus on deporting people who had committed serious crimes and presented threats to public safety. Now that those priorities are really no longer in effect, and so all of these families are at risk of immediate arrest and deportation by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And last week, ICE conducted a nationwide series of sweeps. None of them were actually in Charlotte, but 650 people around the country from this precise group of families and kids were arrested for deportation as recently as last week.
Matenis, have you seen a change in the courtroom or in the Charlotte area since the Trump administration's crackdown?
We have, absolutely. There's a huge amount of fear in the community. As Julia said, this administration has gotten rid of priorities, which used to be those who had committed crimes or who had been recent entries, which a lot of times included these families. But now we're seeing that people who have been here for long periods of time, who have U.S. citizen children, spouses, who have legitimately committed no crime, these people are now being targeted. ICE and the government attorneys in our courtroom have stopped acting with any discretion so that it is clear that the priority is now to deport as many people no matter what. And of course, this has a chilling effect on people showing up for court, not just in immigration, but for criminal cases as well. We're seeing people not reporting crimes. We're seeing witnesses not showing up to criminal court, which is making prosecutors' lives more difficult as the immigrant community loses trust in any governmental entity.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program, Matenis Barola and Julia Preston. Julia is a contributor for the Marshall Project and recently wrote a report about the challenges families seek in facing for families seeking asylum in immigration court. Julia, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
And Matenis Barola is director and managing attorney of the Immigrant Integration Center and the Latin American Coalition, who represents asylum seekers at Charlotte's immigration court. Matenis, thank you for being on the program as well.
Thank you for having me.
You can find out more about the report at our website, stateofthings.org. We turn now to the natural world on the State of Things and the unexpected world of ants coming up. Stay tuned.